So I would like to start with the general consideration about what, in a sense, makes physics different from metaphysics. So there's, the first thing that comes up in, when one thinks about what's the power of a physical law, apart from the explanatory part of it, is the fact that it can be used to make predictions, which are testable. And in a way, the most natural way of thinking about a prediction is to consider a dynamical law, which describes the trajectory, the way in which a physical entity moves in space and time, given some boundary conditions. And that's the traditional way in which physics formulates explanations. So I think since the very start of this enterprise that I think started with Galileo and probably people a bit early on. So the kind of the traditional conception of physics is that laws are expressed in terms of these predictions, and natural way of making a prediction is to have a dynamical law and some boundary conditions in space-time, we would say. And if we had this dynamical laws and boundary conditions, we would have explained all there is to explain about physical reality. However, we all know that really this is not the way we do physics. And in fact, the current status of physics is quite far away from this kind of caricature sort of description of how we go about making explanations and predictions. And in fact, what we have is a bit of a mixture between this dynamical laws approach. We have two theories, general relativity and quantum theory, which are the best corroborated so far. We have some theory about the boundary conditions in space-time, which are not as let's say universal and exact as the dynamical laws. And then we have principles, such as the principles of thermodynamics, the conservation of energy, which are added on top of this picture, and they can provide predictions as well. However, we still like to think of them as slightly less fundamental, and we regard them as emergent and derivative. Although they can guide the search for new theories, and again, they can also provide indirect predictions about physical reality. Now, the kind of thing that I would like to propose is that this assumption that the most fundamental level is the dynamical laws one is a bit arbitrary. And really, we could have a different view, an inverted logic. So we could have something like this. Could formulate exact and scale-independent principles of the same kind as the conservation of energy, and then derive some dynamical laws and boundary conditions that are compatible with such principles. And in a sense, these principles would explain why those dynamical laws and the boundary conditions are the actual ones as opposed to others. And this kind of picture is as viable as the other, and it's really an historical accident that we have started with the dynamical laws and in boundary conditions being more fundamental. So what if really there's a way of formulating these principles that are in such a way that they are scale independent? And what if this kind of description could address problems that currently can't be addressed in the dynamical laws plus initial conditions kind of approach? And just to clarify what I mean, you can think of this. I sometimes give this example where you have a billiard, one of those beautiful dynamical systems. This is not really what it should be. It should be a kind of oval shaped, but it's not. But that's because I'm not a good drawer at all. But okay, just So in the dynamical laws and boundary condition kind of approach, what you do is that you have a certain shape of the of this billiard, and you have a number of particles and the dynamical law, and then you fix a particular initial condition and you see where trajectories of these particles can go. And if you just have one particle, you can do it, and if you have more than one, then some problems occur, etc. But instead, in this other kind of picture that I'm advocating, what you do is that you single out, you give a certain set of conditions on what, for example, can or cannot happen on a subregion of this table, of this billiard thing. And then you work out what boundary conditions and shapes of the boundary are compatible with these kind of constraints. For example, it might be some symmetry constraints, which could be of generalizing something like the conservation of energy. And so we're kind of switching the logic from the traditional way of formulating these dynamical laws, etc., to a different way. The question is, how do we formulate the principles? Because, of course, there are many different ways, and you might have... So the constructor theory approach is a conjecture about how one might go about formulating these exact and scale-independent principles. There may be others, but the distinctive feature of constructor theory is that the principles are formulated in terms of which tasks or physical transformations are possible, which are impossible, and why. And so going back to this picture, you could say, for example, that suppose I want to know all the boundary conditions and dynamical laws that are compatible with the fact that a certain region of the table is completely inaccessible. So it's impossible for a particle to ever get into this region, as opposed to having a particular shape and then working out where the particles can go, given that dynamical laws are of a certain kind. Okay, so what I would like to get across in this talk are two points, basically. One is that there are certain problems that the dynamical law type of approach cannot address. And paradoxically, these problems are... they emerge in the context of dynamical laws, but they really can't be addressed in that context. So I will give you an example, which is an application of constructor theory, that has to do with a question of whether two dynamical theories like quantum theory and general relativity can coexist in the universe. So the question is whether there can be a consistent model where one sector of the universe is described by, let's say, a classical theory, such as GR, and another sector of the universe is described by quantum theory. And the question is whether this kind of situation is consistent. It's a viable model for the universe or not. This is actually... has a very long tradition, but I will show that it's an example of a problem that can't be really handled by the prevailing conception, the traditional conceptual approach. And I will show how, if you apply the tools of constructor theory, you can address it. So the general point, though, will be, in talking about this example, I'll point out features of constructor theory that are helpful in addressing the problem. And this work that I'm going to talk about is joint work with Vlatko Vedral, and also part of the work is joint with David Deutsch, so and the combination of my own work as well. So it'll be it's probably a summary of the last 3 or 4 years of research on this topic. Let me start with talking a bit about constructor theory. So as I said, constructor theory's laws are principles, and they are designed to constrain other theories, which are these dynamical theories, which we call subsidiary theories, because the idea is that the principles should supplement them somehow. There are a number of points to understand about constructor theory before we can get to the example. Okay, let's talk about what a task is. So a task is a transformation specified in terms of some input attributes of objects that can be changed, which are called substrates, and output attributes of the substrates. So a familiar example something like, you know, this is a task. It's a task that you can perform on a bit, so it's a knot. And 0, 1, 1, sorry, 1, 0 are 0, 1 are two attributes of a system. Could be a spin or anything. So you can think of these as being extremely general kind of entities. In the sense that substrates could be anything. It could be any system given that by the subsidiary theory. So the constructor for a task is some object that can perform the task, and whenever given the input attributes, the legitimate ones, will deliver the output attributes deterministically. For example, a coffee machine, you know, you insert the right substrate in, and then you press a button, and then it delivers the substrates in the right subspace. I mean, for example, hopefully a cappuccino or something like that, a double espresso or whatever. Constructor is characterized just like the coffee machine by the fact that it preserves the property of causing the transformation again at the end of the transformation. So it uses up some of the substrates, but it itself keeps the ability of causing the transformation again. So it's a cycle. It's a bit like something like a catalyst or some object which retains this ability of causing the task. So for example, the coffee machine wouldn't be a good coffee machine if it, you know, were to dissolve after one use of it. In fact, in reality, we don't have perfect constructors. It's a bit like what happens with thermodynamic cycles. We can only ever get arbitrarily close to the behavior of a constructor, because there are errors occurring, etc. But there are certain tasks for which one can get really arbitrarily close to the ideal behavior of a machine that can deliver the substrates in the right output. And those tasks are the tasks that we call possible. A task is impossible if a law of physics forbids it being performed by a constructor to arbitrarily high accuracy. So in quantum theory, for example, we know that if we have two non-orthogonal states of a qubit, for example, we know that it's impossible to copy those two states to arbitrarily high accuracy. And so the copying of two non-orthogonal states in quantum theory would be an example of an impossible task, because we can provide certain machines that can probabilistically clone those states, but only ever to a finite accuracy, and there's a limitation which can't be improved upon. Whereas two orthogonal states can be copied to arbitrarily high accuracy, and therefore the task of copying them is a possible task. And likewise, you could say in the case of, perpetual motion machine of the first kind is impossible because there's a finite accuracy, there's a finite limit beyond which you can't go in building up a machine that creates energy out of no energy. The message to get out of this is that as you can see, I'm talking about tasks and not constructors. So one of the important things that happen in constructor theory is that you switch to talking about possibility and impossibility of tasks on a subsystem of the universe, which is the substrate, and you abstract away the design of the constructor. So instead of saying that, trying to talk about the impossibility of a perpetual motion machine by coming up with the particular design of a particular machine and then checking whether the dynamical laws and the initial conditions are compatible with its existence, one states the fact that it is impossible to change the energy of a substrate. And that is a statement that doesn't really force you to think of all the possible designs for perpetual motion machines that you can come up with. It's just to construct this abstracted way. And this allows one to formulate, hopefully, laws in such a way that they are simpler than they would look like in the prevailing conception, in the traditional kind of conceptual approach. So this thing about abstracting away the constructor is important, and constructor theory is not about constructors. That's a thing that has to be remembered, because, I mean, you wouldn't say that from the name. So we can now switch to this application, and so this is going to be part of the representation of the problem. But I would like to say that in the course of explaining this, there are two things I want to make sure that kind of come across in this explanation. So one is that this logic of explaining features of the universe by constraining, confining attention to a subsystem of it and providing constraints about possible and impossible tasks on that subsystem and then inferring consequences for the whole universe is inverted logic with respect to the traditional conception, and it is a powerful feature that actually allows one to address questions of this kind. So that's one point. And the other point is that although it might look like you could solve this problem by the traditional conception approach, the constructor theoretic approach is much more powerful because it's independent of any particular dynamical law and allows one to talk about formulate constraints that don't have to be confined to a particular dynamical model or a set of them. So these are the two important things that will come up in the discussion, hopefully. Okay, so the problem is this. You have two sectors of two systems. A quantum system. For the moment, let's not worry about what that means. Just let's say it's a system described by unitary quantum theory. And then we have another sector, the C sector, which is described by some classical non-quantum theory. And again, I won't specify now what that means, but just think of, for example, something that cannot be, well, that has, let's say, just a single observable and doesn't have complementarity, doesn't have two complementary observables. The one of the most striking things that occur in a quantum system is that, so we are accustomed to thinking that, you know, if you have a... it's the fact that you have this complementarity of observables. And this means this. So in a classical system, you can always think of suppose you have a number of properties or attributes of this system. So let's say, the system can be in a number of states. We can think of 0 and 1, for example, just for simplicity. Now, all the distinct states of a classical system can be put together in a set, and that can be called an observable. Because you can always think of a measure of a machine that would be capable of performing, let's say, a perfect measurement on, in principle, which would discriminate these two states from one another. So the machine would do something like, so if I provide the machine with the classical system in state 0, this machine will, which can be initialized, let's say this is a machine, it's a tape, initializes some blank state, will do something like 0, 0, which quoted 0 just means the machine says it's a 0. And, you know, if you start with a 1, the same will happen. So the machine is performing a perfect measurement because it's a measurement that doesn't perturb the system. So the system stays the same. And there's a perfect correlation between the two, the tape of the machine, the kind of display, and the original value of the system. So the dynamics of the machine is designed, so this is a constructor, let's say. So let's call it in a different way, let's call it like measure of this property T. And for all states of a classical system, in principle, you can devise a machine that would have this property. So it would be capable of discriminating those states to arbitrarily high accuracy. In quantum systems, that's not the case. So there are distinct states that can't be discriminated to this accuracy. So a quantum system has a property that, for example, might have two different observables. So let's say X and Z. We can, again, you know, Z, let's say it's a binary observable, and X is a different binary observable. And by observable, I mean that, you know, something that has a property that you can devise a machine that would do that for each one of the two sets. So, for example, plus blank goes to plus, it's a plus, and plus blank and minus blank goes to minus, it's a minus. And likewise for zero, you can do the same. So there's a different machine. So this is an M of X. Not sure if everyone can see. And you can also think of an M of Z, a different machine that would be capable of doing the same for zero and one. So the classical property is preserved in the case of for these two observables separately. But then if you think of the collection of the two, so if you think of, you know, of the union of these two sets, let's say, so something like plus, minus, zero, and one. In a quantum system, in general, there exist sets of states with the property that if you consider this union, you wouldn't have a single machine that would be capable of doing this. And that's the complementarity of observables. So it's the existence of states, of sets of states that can be simultaneously measured to arbitrary high accuracy by a single machine. Is that now clear? Mm-hmm. Okay. So a classical system, you might think of it as being something that has a set of states, and the union of all of these states has the property that it can be copied in this way. Okay. But let's just talk about the generic problem for the moment. So have that in mind. This will be useful for later. So the problem is a hybrid system which is composed of two interacting quantum classical sectors possible? So the box here represents some kind of interaction which will be clarified later. But so the question is, can we have you know, two descriptions of the universe which are compatible with one another, could they coexist? So let's say, you know, you have quantum theory on the side and then classical theory on the other side, for example, gravity. This classical sector could be anything, though. It could be a classical field. It could be some macroscopic object which is supposed not to be capable of undergoing interference, quantum interference, and so on. So this is a very general question, although it's relevant to gravity, and in fact it probably very, gravity is one of the most prominent examples of this problem. It's a more general problem than just the quantum gravity problem. So historically, I think there were a number of attempts to address this question. So there was an attempt by Heisenberg, who was thinking about what would happen to the classical electromagnetic field if interacting with a quantum charged particle. And then there was Feynman, who was trying to approach the same question with the gravitational field. Then more recently, people like Asher Peres and Terno and other quantum gravity kind of people try to address the same question in different formalism. But the ways in which the problem is addressed in the traditional conception have a number of shortcomings. And these are basically the shortcomings. So the way in which the traditional conception would go in addressing the problem is to pick a particular dynamical model for the two sides. For example, unitary quantum theory on one side, on the quantum side, and some other classical dynamical model on the other side. And then show that the model is inconsistent at the global level. So the dynamics of the composite system shows some inconsistency of some form. And usually the form in which the inconsistency comes up is that the quantum sector this property, the property, for example, the some of the characteristic properties of the quantum sectors are violated, or the this property of complementarity or uncertainty, let's say, is spread to the classical sector. So in one way or another, the assumptions of the model are sort of violated. And that's the kind of way in which the argument for showing that those two systems can't coexist together usually go. However, the problems are that the shortcomings of these kind of approaches are that each one of them has to fix a particular dynamical model. And these models usually have features like that are very close to the ones that quantum theory has. So, for example, the overall dynamics is supposed to be unitary, which is a feature that quantum theory. So it seems to put in at the start what the argument is supposed to show. Unitarity is a very strong requirement because a unitary evolution, like the one that quantum systems undergo, is a reversible dynamical law. It's a linear dynamical law, and these two features are very strong sort of assumptions. And more generally, the models are just specific to a particular dynamical model. So if you pick a different, there's no way of talking about a different dynamical model unless you come up with, you know, yet another argument. And so it's a bit like what I was saying before in regard to talking about the impossibility of a perpetual motion machine of the first kind. One way would be to say, okay, given these dynamical laws and initial conditions, no such machine will happen because every particular design is incompatible with the laws. That's the traditional conceptual approach. And constructor theory has a different kind of approach to that question. And it has a different approach to this question as well. And I'll show you now that if you can formulate a different argument in constructor theory, which is based on information theoretic concepts. And this argument is independent of particular dynamical models. And it has this beautiful feature of showing what are the minimal properties that you have to require on a subsystem of the universe, the quantum one, for it to be capable of spreading its properties to the rest of the universe. So it's a theme that I mentioned early on. This inverted logic from the traditional conception. Instead of explaining a particular what happens in a particular subregion of the universe in terms of the boundary conditions and, you know, how the universe was at the start, you explain how the universe must be by giving certain conditions on a subsystem of it. And also, you know, it has the appealing feature that it's being the fact that it, as we'll see, is an information theoretic argument. It can apply to theories which haven't yet been conceived, just like the principle of conservation of energy does apply to theories yet to be known, and in particular post-quantum theories or theories that might be conceived as successive of quantum theory. So those theories might still have the features of quantum theory, but not quite, and yet this argument would apply to them, so long as they have this property of complementarity that I will now explain a bit more detail. Okay, so what I'm going to say now is going to somehow formalize what I just said there in constructive theoretic terms, and the thing to retain is basically that these definitions that I'm going to give are finalized. I mean, their aim is just to provide a generalized characterization of the quantum and the classical sector, which is independent of particular models, dynamical models, okay? And so this will require introducing a number of things from constructive theory of information, but really the aim of all this is to characterize those quantum and classical sectors in a more general way, and also the interaction between them, which, as we will see, is connected with the possibility of performing a perfect measurement or a kind of measurement between the two. So measurement intended as a machine that can do something like this. I'll just explain it now. So, okay, first we need to talk about the classical sector in some sense. So the classical sector is supposed to be, and I'll clarify this later, is an information medium. So an information medium in constructor theory can be is a particular kind of substrate which is characterized in terms of certain tasks being possible on it. And so it's a system that has a number of attributes, for example, 0 and 1. So let's I'll try this one now. Can I just write here? Yeah, I think so. So it's a system with, let's say, a set of attributes with a certain property. And the properties are expressed in terms of possible and impossible tasks. So one, in fact, possible tasks. So one property is that the attributes can be permuted in all possible ways, in which case this means, you know, zero can, that there's a constructor for this task. You know, zero goes to one, one goes to zero, there's a permutation. And then the other permutation is a trivial one. So zero goes to zero, one goes to one, it's the identity. So let's say that's not, and that's the identity. And we require these two tasks to be possible, which I denote by this tick. Then another set of tasks is required to be possible on these systems for them to qualify as information media. This copy operation that I was mentioning must also be possible. So if you have two such systems with each one of them these two attributes, you would like to be able to perform tasks of this kind, which, with hindsight from what we said early on, look like perfect measurements, where this first slot is one system, and the second slot is a copy of the same system. So an information medium is a medium M with the property that you can do this on a single, on the system by its own, and you can do this other task. There's a constructor for it, a different one, when you have two replicas of the system. So this is really a copy operation. If you think of what happens when you have two bits, that's a copy of the set 0,1 onto the other bit. And so whenever you have a system that satisfies, that has these conditions satisfied, we call that an information medium. And note that this is characterized in terms of possible and impossible tasks. It's a scan-independent kind of characterization. It's just requiring certain transformations to be possible in a system. And in constructor theory, you give also a principle that rules these kind of systems, substrates, which is an example of an additional principle that constructor theory formulates and will be relevant for the argument. And it's called the interoperability principle of information. Now, apart from the formal expression of it, which is elegant in a sense, because it says that if you have two information media of different kinds, so let's say you have something like an electron, which can instantiate a bit, and the photon that can also instantiate a bit, you put them together, and what you would expect from what we observe is that the composite system of electrons and photons can also itself be used as an information medium. So it should have a set of states with the property that they can be permuted and copied in all possible ways. And so therefore this is a requirement on which need not be satisfied by actual systems. So it's a principle that's, if you have a theory of the universe where there are two sectors which can only weakly interact with one another, a dark sector and a non-dark sector, for example, that kind of picture wouldn't be compatible with this principle because there wouldn't be strong enough interactions between the two for a copy operation to occur between sector one and sector two. Whereas this principle requires that whenever you have two systems that can store and manipulate information, if you consider the composite system, that property holds on the composite system as well. And in particular, this requirement requires the possibility of copying information from one system to the other and vice versa. And the nice thing is that, again, it can be formulated without reference to constructors. This is, again, a statement about the tasks only. Once we have this, we can also talk about a more general thing than just a perfect measure, and that's something that can distinguish two states. So this is the concept of distinguishability, which is once we have this notion of information medium and information variable, which is this set of states that can be permuted and copied in all possible ways, we can define what distinguishing two states mean without circularity in a way. And this will be relevant for the argument because this will be something that we'll use in order to characterize how the interaction must go between the two sectors. A variable is a distinguishable variable. So in this thing, this is X. You can set up a certain interaction by which the variable in question is mapped by a constructor onto some information variable, which again is a variable with the property that can be copied and permuted in all possible ways. So it's a bit like saying, suppose you have a system, you don't know whether its attributes, whether there's a set of attributes that can be distinguished. A way of telling whether that can be the case is to try to make it interact with something that is an information medium and see whether those states can be mapped onto things that can themselves be copied and permuted. And that if that task is possible, then the variable in question is distinguishable. So going back to this kind of picture, distinguishing states is a kind of weaker requirement than having a perfect measurement, because the perfect measurement requires the system to be unperturbed, whereas a distinguishing operation may send 0 and 1 to things that are two generic states, S1 and S0 and S1. And so long as these two are part of an information variable so that they can be permuted in all possible ways and copied, even though they don't retain the original identity of the two states that you started with, you still retain the capacity of distinguishing the two states. And that's enough to say that these two states are distinguishable. So that's the kind of idea behind this definition. So it's a weaker requirement than the possibility of having a perfect copy. But still, there is the requirement that you can tell apart the two states with a different machine, which comes later on in this line. A set of attributes X is measurable if you can perform this particular task, which is of which those ones are a special case. So I just already talked about this early on. So in regard to the quantum sector, we need to add, we need to talk about complementarity. So this is generalizing constructor theory by the notion of a super information medium. So if let's say this is a set of all, let's say these are information media. So these are physical systems that satisfy the properties that I mentioned there. Super information media that I'm going to define now are a subsystem of them. So they are kind of subset. Sorry, not subsystem, a subset of them. So it's like a... So they are a subset of these substrates that satisfy an additional condition, which will generalize this condition that I was talking about in regard to quantum systems. Super information medium, and perhaps we can look at this example since it's already here, is an information medium which has two information variables, so let's say X and Z. That means that each one of these two attributes can be permuted and copied in all possible ways, with the property that if you consider the union of the two, which is the thing that I wrote here, that thing is not itself permutable and copyable. in the case of a quantum system, the thing that fails at this stage is the copyability of the set. So a superinformation, I mean, a qubit is a particular superinformation medium with these two information variables, the 0, 1 and the plus minus. So I'm not sure if you're familiar with this sort of notation, but never mind that. It's just repeating what I said early on about complementarity of observables in quantum systems. Okay, so at this point we can restate the assumptions of the argument that I was mentioning early on by using the concept of an information medium and of a superinformation medium. And as we have seen, the characterization of them is independent of dynamical laws. So the classical sector is an information medium with a unique single observable T, or information variable T. So going back to this thing that I was describing here, is a system whose with a set of attributes that can be permuted and copied in all possible ways. And we know that there are no other distinguishable, that there are no other states. So let's say we are supposing that all of the states of the system are part of this big observable, and there are no other complementary. So we are assuming that there are no complementary observables on this side. So all of the things that can be measured in this sense can be all put in together in a single set of attributes, and that set can be itself measured perfectly by some interaction of this kind. And this says that the system is classical because it has no complementary observables. It's a generalization of that concept. And the quantum sector is a superinformation medium, so it's a substrate with two information variables. Each one of them can be perfectly discriminated. So the states, so for example, X and Z, these two states can be perfectly discriminated by this mean, and likewise for the other two. And if you put them together, you consider the union of them, there is no machine that would perform this perfect copy operation on all of the states. And in addition, we assume that when we put the two systems together, we assume something about the way in which we perform measurements of Z and X. So let me just clarify what that means. There's an additional assumption on the quantum sector, and I'm trying to explain what that means. On the quantum sector, there are two things that can be perfectly measured in the copy-like sense that I defined early on. One is X, and let's take something that's binary just for simplicity. And the other one is Z. Okay, so each one of the two will have some measure that can, so for example, for Z, there's some machine, which we can call M of Z, which does what I said early on. So 0, 0 goes to 0, 0, and that's a measure of Z. And 1, 0 goes to 1, 1. And this is the quantum system, so that's the quantum sector, let's say. Let's call it S. And this is the system where we read out the measurement result, which could be a generic system. But, so let's call it S prime. It's just a display of the measure, let's say. And now, what the additional requirement is about is what happens if you present this measure of Z with the other two states in X. So the tape or the readout system is always in the same blank state. And we put on the first system the other two states, which we know cannot be perfectly discriminated from 0 and 1. But of course, the machine must go to some other two states because it's a system, and you know, it could hopefully will not explode and do something. And even if it explodes, that will be a different dynamical, is a different state. So we know you can call that, let's say, S plus and S minus. And that represents the joint state of these two systems after two different input states from the legitimate ones have been proposed to the machine, which can perfectly discriminate 0 and 1. What we require is that these two states are still two distinguishable states. So distinguishable in the sense that I mentioned before. So they can be copied and permuted. Note that that doesn't require them to be distinguished from these other states. But so that's the sort of requirement that we add on the quantum sector, and which also forces the interaction between it and other systems of the universe to be of a certain kind. Okay? Now, conclusion of the argument is that under these assumptions, the classical sector turn out to, what turns out is that it must have another set of attributes, which I call S in this slide, other than T, other than this classical, other than this perfectly measurable observable, with the property that S and T are complementary. So the classical sector, as a consequence of these assumptions, must be itself a superinformation medium with two complementary observables. And the way this is proven, roughly speaking, is that instead of this S prime, which is a generic system, we put the classical sector here, and we follow the consequences of these assumptions. And they imply that the classical system must have additional states than the ones that we started with. So in addition to the perfectly distinguishable states 0 and 1, the classical sector must also have additional states which are complementary to those states. So we show that if this is the quantum sector and that's the classical sector, we start with the assumption that the classical sector only has two states, two attributes, which are perfectly distinguishable. And the conclusion of the argument is that there must be, as a result of the possibility of having an interaction between the quantum sector and the classical sector, which corresponds to a measurement satisfying this constraint, the classical sector must itself have a different observable or information variable, which can be something like S1, S2, with the property that it itself is a superinformation medium with these two observables, which means that they are complementary in the sense that I said before. So there's no machine that could discriminate the set of S1, S2, 0, and 1. So that just like in this example. In other words, the same property of complementarity that you start with on the quantum sector must spread to the classical sector as a result of these assumptions. So that's an argument for why the classical sector must itself be quantum, if by quantum you take, having this property of complementarity. And again, this argument is not dependent on dynamical laws, not on a particular dynamical law. It's also interesting that the assumption is not as strong as the unitarity assumption that was present in previous arguments, because this interaction might be irreversible, for example, in the sense that these two S plus and S minus states, it might not be possible to retrieve perfectly plus and minus. But yet you can conclude that this property of complementarity must spread to the classical sector of the universe that we started with. Okay, so that's the the two things to notice in this argument are that since you switch this information theoretic characterization, you forget about dynamical models, and in fact, there'll be a number of dynamical models which are compatible with this requirement, but you give the requirements at this higher level, which makes the argument much more powerful because it can constrain a number of a much wider set of theories than you would be otherwise be capable of constraining if you were to stick to a particular dynamical model as it was done in the past. And the other thing that is beautiful is that it shows this remarkable fact that it's possible to give local constraint on a system, the quantum sector, and then work out what consequences those constraints have for the whole universe, really. Because if this is true, then you can't have a subsystem of the universe, provided that the assumptions are satisfied, which is classical and stays by itself. So long as that subsystem can be used to store information, so long as it has one observable, then because it can be used as a target of a measurement device acting on the quantum sector, then it itself must be quantum. So it itself must have this uncertainty property associated with the presence of complementary observables. So the kind of summary before we conclude is that this same logic might apply to other problems, and in fact that's the kind of enterprise that constructor theory is trying to realize, in the sense that as we have seen, there are problems that which you can't really address in the traditional conceptual approach, because that confines you to a particular dynamical model or a particular dynamical theory. And instead, in certain cases, you need a different take on the problem to address it. And you can make exact predictions coming. You can have exact predictions coming out of principles given at a higher level. So, for example, in this case, you might be able to conclude that. You are able to conclude that there must exist at least two other states of a physical system, just by indirect implication from the principle that those two systems must interact in a certain way because of the interoperability principle of information, for example. As I said, this idea that laws formulated on a subpart of the universe can have implications on the whole, and so we may actually be better off in switching the logic from the traditional conception, and that's what constructor theory is aiming at realizing. And so, just to give you like the final sort of final thought, so to illustrate this logic, so. You ask this to a traditional conception person, and they might go like, well, the reason why this is a draw, so you must imagine some sort of situation where there are two players, they're sitting there, and they're looking at this board, and they're kind of saying, okay, this is a draw, fine. And the traditional conception approach person would say, reason why that's a draw is that, the dynamical laws of the universe are of a certain kind. And the initial conditions or boundary conditions in space-time were of a certain kind, and that implies that the next state of the configuration the next state of the minds of the players is such that there can be a state which corresponds to a strategy which would allow one of the two players to move on and let this state of the board move from this state to a state where, you know, checkmate occurs. Now, this kind of explanation sounds convoluted, not just because I'm biased towards constructor theory and I'm making it sound as such, but the point is that you have to explain why this state can't evolve to a different state where there's a checkmate. By referring to the configurations of the minds of the players, all those particles, and work out these dynamical laws, etc., and start with the boundary conditions and so on. But there's a much simpler explanation, really, which forgets about the minds of the players and so on. It only focuses on the board, and in fact, on the tasks the moves that are available to the knight and to the king. And the real reason why this state of the board can't evolve into a checkmate state is really to do with what tasks are possible on the knight and the king. So where the knight can go and where the king can go. And that's a minimal, simpler explanation, which is much more powerful and tells us much more than the traditional conceptual approach. So my guess is that this might be the case for most, well, for some of the open problems that are in physics now. And constructor theory is the enterprise is trying to check whether this guess is correct or not.